Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we'll have an hour of Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader joins us live in the first part of the show to speak about his latest book from Seven Stories Press, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President from 2001 to 2015. Later in the program, we'll hear excerpts from a speech Ralph Nader gave last summer where he elaborated on the idea of a left-right alliance against the corporate state. Please stay with us for an hour with Ralph Nader. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We have with us today an amazing guest, Ralph Nader. He's joining us live to discuss his new book, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. Later in the program, we'll hear portions of a speech he gave about potential left-right alliance against the corporate state. But right now, here's Peter Phillips to introduce Ralph Nader.
Looking at Seven Stories Press summary of Ralph Nader, they call him the America's first citizen. He's a lawyer, author, saved countless lives, co-founded numerous public interest groups, including Public Citizen, the Center for Auto Safety, Disability Rights Center, the Pension Rights Center, the Center for the Study of Responsive Law. And he's credited with having passed more major legislation in the 20th century than all but three presidents. He's challenged abuses by corporate and government officials and urged citizens to use their time, energy, and democratic rights to demand greater institutional accountability. Ralph also did the introduction to our Censored 2015 book. Ralph Nader, are you with us?
Yes, Peter. Thank you. Nice to be with you and Mickey.
Great to have you on, and we're certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Really, what's fresh on your mind right now? There's many things happening, certainly an election coming up. What's the thing you want to really address most clearly?
Well, I'm looking at a $2 bill, and one side of the $2 bill has a picture of the patriots who convened on July 4th, 1776, to issue the Declaration of Independence. And the message they gave us was, democracy starts with people showing up. They showed up. And the biggest problem in our country today is not the lack of solutions. It's not the lack of goodwill. It's not the lack of left-right convergence to turn this country around in one area after another and make it look easy. It's the almost strange unwillingness to show up at town meetings, to show up for good candidates on the ballot, to show up in courts, to show up in marches and rallies. And instead, we have a younger generation that's part of the hanging head society. That is, they're looking at their smartphone hours at a time.
Well, Ralph, this is Mickey Huff. Thanks again for coming on the program today. The hanging head society, it's again interesting. You know, one of the things that we do at Project Censored is we work with a lot of students. So I wanted to have at least some of the good news angle of that is we work with a lot of students around the country that really are active. And I think that some of these people, I think they're following in your footsteps in some ways in your half century of activism. But back to your statement, how would you categorize or how would you explain this? Is it pervasive cynicism? Do you see it as maybe some kind of apathy? Or do you see it that the institutions don't invite younger voices to these kinds of democratic so-called happenings?
Well, Mickey, ask yourself, how did these student projects that feed the material into Project Censored get underway? They got underway because an older generation, like Peter, tutors them, instructs them, motivates them. The arm around the shoulder by the older generation to the younger generation is not that prevalent in town, country, and city America. And there is a real gap. Now, we always hear of generation gaps. This one is an insufficient attention by people in their 50s, 60s, 70s to people in their teens, 20s, 30s. And that's what we got to bridge, because I have a lot of young people say to me, we want to improve the country and the world. We want to save this. We want to preserve that. We want to help this. But we don't know how to do it. Tell us how to do it. Well, we're not telling them politically, are we? I mean, look, are enough progressive candidates running at the local, state, and national level? No. They're folding into the corporatist, militarist segment of the Democratic Party. And the same is true all the way down to Main Street and Elm Street. There's just not enough armor on the shoulder, seminars, civic skill gatherings, all kinds of things. Now, it is happening here and there, and that's what we should learn from. I mean, you gave the example of the students. That's what we should learn from. Those exceptions should be motivational examples to spread and diffuse throughout our society, because we're pretty much stuck in the mud as a country. We're sliding behind. The majority of people are making less today in inflation-adjusted wages than people made in 1973, even though the economy has doubled. But it's doubled in gains to the top 2 or 1%.
Ralph Nader, you were mentioning, are there enough progressive candidates? Are there enough of these people running in local areas and so on? And of course, that brings me to one of the questions that naturally corporate media is always ever enthralled with, the endless horse race reporting on the upcoming presidential election, which isn't until November of 2016. But already, right, we've seen a lot of attention here, and we're seeing some attention on this Bernie Sanders throwing his hat in the ring for the Democratic Party. We were curious as to your take on some of this and what potential this might have in such an election within the Democratic Party.
Well, it's here we go again. What happens in the Democratic primaries are sometimes there are progressive candidates that throw their hat in the ring. Jesse Jackson, for example, Dennis Kucinich. And what happens is that they are marginalized. Even Kucinich was kept off some debates, even though he was a longtime member of Congress and former mayor of Cleveland, Ohio. And what happens is they're done by April and May, and the Democratic Party nominee, the winner, basically is the one that represents the corporatist and militarist interests, as Hillary Clinton will do if she wins the nomination, Wall Street to Washington. So what happens is that while there's a flurry of media on, say, Bernie Sanders' progressive 12-point program, and he'll get on maybe 6 Democratic primary debates, which will be televised to small audiences. By the time the nominee is chosen, unless he really strikes pay dirt and wins the nomination, by the time the nominee is chosen, he can't go to November, and he is asked to pledge loyalty to the eventual presidential nominee by the Democratic Party, which he's already done. And so that produces despair among progressives, and they're confronted once again with the least worst option. Oh, you got to vote for the Democratic nominee because the Republicans are worse. And every 4 years, this cycle turns out a worse Democratic and a worse Republican Party. That's what the scenario is, because we have a two-party tyranny that excludes third parties in every imaginable way, wears them out, takes them off the ballot. It keeps them off the debates. No media, no polls, can't raise money. There's no Western country in the world that comes close to excluding challenging candidates, a multi-party competition, and voting rights. We do badly by way of discouraging voters from voting, sometimes maliciously, as we have seen in recent years. And we also make sure that we're not a competitive democracy with alternative scenarios for the future, which always throughout American history have come from third parties. Abolition of slavery, women's right to vote, farmer, progressive, worker movements, all came first from third parties who managed to get on the ballot. But it's harder now for third parties than it was in the 19th century.
Ralph, I've read through your book, and it's really amazing. You've got all kinds of different subjects in here, everything from corporate personhood to taxing the wealthy, dealing with cluster bombs, civilian death in the wars, legalizing hemp, global warming, No Child Left Behind. All of those are very important issues. And all of those issues, I think young people are very concerned about. But when they look at these two parties, they go, nobody's going to do anything. It's not going to make any difference. We write books every year that bring out all of these different issues and questions. And in what direction can we tell young people that they can take outside of the two corporate parties?
Well, the one closest to you, Peter, is Project Censored, and the students who you mobilized believe they could make a difference, and they did make a difference in their investigations. And that's the first step to any change, is to alert people to what's going on that outrages them, and we hope motivates them to push for corrective action. So the way I talk to young people is simple. You got to grow up. They don't like to hear that. You got to grow up. And they say, what do you mean? I say, look, there are two easy ways to go through life. You can believe everything or disbelieve everything. Both ways avoid thinking. That's number one. Number two, young people are in millions in numbers. They could mobilize at the local level. They could create new parties, take over local governments, because they have the energy. They got the foot power, the brain power, the heart power. They haven't been worn down by years of hegemonic or plutocratic attrition, but they don't know their own power. Who can tell them about their power? Well, it's our generation that can tell them, and they can go through examples in American history. I mean, look what the students did in the 1960s. They shortened the wars. They expanded the civil rights movement. They put the environmental movement on the map with Earth Day. They expanded student rights. But they tend to lose steam because they don't build institutions. That's why I spent so much time starting student public interest research groups, the PIRGs, that are in 20 states or so, including California. They have full-time people that they hire. Lawyers, investigators, writers, lobbyists, and these PIRGs really make a difference. And they're run by student board of directors elected by the student body in various universities and colleges. So I think we've got plenty of material to persuade the young, but we have to reach them in other ways than a 140-character tweet or through the social media. I mean, the social media is great to get information, to tell people there are events here and there. And it doesn't motivate people to get out in the village square, to get out in the streets, into the town meetings, to mobilize, to vote. That can only happen by person-to-person meetings. They may be small to begin with, 10, 15 in a town or a city or a neighborhood, but nothing ever starts full-blown. Everything starts with one or two people, and that's what we've got to do. We got to get it all over the country, unified around a major agenda, which I had on my website when I was running for president in 2008. It's still on the website, votenator.org. I kept it open for that purpose, votenator.org. You'll see all these major redirections, full Medicare for all, the single payer, living wage, cracking down on corporate crime, pulling back on the empire, changing the tax code, preserving the environment here and there. They're all majoritarian support, even left-right support for a lot of these. So, you know, when you got left-right majoritarian support, as I described in my book Unstoppable last year, you got a winner. They can't stop a left-right coalition. Anytime we got in Congress a left-right coalition, it's a slam dunk, like the Freedom of Information Act of 1974, like the Whistleblower Protection Act of 2013. The corporate lobbies fought this tooth and nail, but they lost because it was up against the left-right coalition.
We're speaking with Ralph Nader. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Ralph Nader, your newest book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001-2015. Tell us a little bit about this book and your discussions. You've undoubtedly had some discussion with Dan Simon and Seven Stories Press. How did this book come about? Obviously, you wrote a lot of letters that, well, weren't responded to. So tell us a little bit about this.
Well, the larger message of the book is that the most democratic media, with apologies to Pacifica Radio, is a citizen writing a letter to an elected official. That letter, once it's sent, cannot be cut up, censored, distorted. It comes from the mind and heart of the citizen. And that's something we call correspondence. Remember our early patriots? They started committees of correspondence to mobilize against King George III. Well, correspondence has a great history in our country when the elected officials responded to it. But now, more and more, they don't respond. They don't even acknowledge the letters. And so when I started writing these letters to George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and I realized that they not only didn't respond, their staff didn't respond, their department agencies didn't respond. I mean, you don't expect the president to respond to every letter. I began to realize that they didn't even acknowledge receipt. And, you know, in an era of national security, you know, people can say, well, I don't know if this letter's even getting there. I got the right stamp on it, but I don't know if it's even getting there. And after a while, they get discouraged, and they don't even bother writing. So the politicians are snuffing out a very democratic media that historically has told presidents what they should do, what they shouldn't do, thereby raising expectations of the public of the presidential function, and also telling presidents about things they don't know about that are occurring in the country or things that they don't know about in their own government, in their own departments. That's what this book does. It's a whole variety of letters. And for people with short attention spans, this should be a bestseller, huh, Peter? You know, Mick?
They're letters of 1,000 words at the most.
It's a way to encourage people. My best guess, based on audiences I ask questions of, I say, how many of you have ever written a letter to your president? And about 10 to 15% raise their hands. That's not enough. That's not enough. You know, I wrote two critical letters to the Prime Minister of Canada, who's a horrid right-winger, Stephen Harper. Back comes an official recognition that they received the letter. It was signed by the Chief of Correspondence. They absorbed the contents, and they're referring it to the respective ministries. I mean, that's the way you operate. It's like a dark hole in the White House. You know, they have dozens of volunteers opening the letters and categorizing them, and they will respond to invitations to social functions with regrets, like, will you come to my graduation? They will respond to contributors if they're large enough. They will send out robo-letters, form letters on high-profile issues like the GM bailout, even though the letter is laughably not responsive to the specific letter. I've had that experience, and that's in the book. But when it comes to letters of substance, of proposal, of ideas, of alert, they can't be bothered. And by the way, members of Congress are trending in that direction, too. They just don't respond. Even your allies in Congress don't even bother responding to letters. That's why I wrote the book, and to generate this kind of discussion. You should write your members of Congress and say, how dare you? If I send you next week or next month, Senator or Representative, a substantive letter or an idea, are you going to respond? See, that'll shake up the office in Washington.
So letters, email, communications, tweets to the White House, is all of that effective in some way? I mean, are they counting?
They count the emails on certain issues that they're concerned about, like if they want to see what the public reaction is to invading Syria. That was overwhelmingly negative, and I think that did have an impact a couple years ago to restrain Obama. But by and large, you know, they rely on polls. They think polls are a better barometer because they ask the questions, right? Whereas in letters, it's the people who are asking the questions. That produces considerable discomfort in officialdom here in Washington.
So, and this combination here, let's ask about that. You're a lawyer, and the U.S. Court of Appeals at the Second Circuit just ruled against sweeping surveillance programs by NSA and other intelligence agencies. And that seemed like a victory to us, certainly some limitations on this massive spying, our loss of civil liberties. Is this a good step forward?
Very good step forward, although the court decision was based on the Patriot Act statute. They didn't say it was unconstitutional. That's going to be another case. But they said the Patriot Act statute does not authorize the NSA to put in a computer bank every phone call and every email as these giant computers scoop up all our communications. Doesn't mean they read them. They couldn't read them, but they bank them for future reference. Big brother.
Ralph Nader, another issue that's going on right now that we've written about in the last couple of years at Project Censored, and certainly you've also written about this, in fact, recently, President Obama has now been talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade pact that most people have never heard of. And he's of course, putting a lot of spin on what he sees it, and he has some resistance, of course, but he's been on David Letterman. I mean, he's been all over the place trying to spin how the TPP is somehow good for Americans. And you wrote a piece recently on May Day about Senator Warren and Obama should debate her on this global economic pact. You want to talk about TPP a little bit?
Yeah, it's very easy for President Obama to come down from his presidential perch and spread gross misinformation about what's in this multi-hundred page so-called trade agreement. I call it a proposed treaty, but he likes to call it a trade agreement because all he needs is 51% in the House and Senate, whereas in a treaty, he needs two-thirds of the Senate, and that's more difficult to ram it through. But this Trans-Pacific Partnership, as it's euphemistically called, is just a further elaboration of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization in the wrong direction. That is, it disadvantages the USA. And you might say, well, how does it do that? The main bargainers are U.S. global corporations and their lawyers. Yeah, that's my point. These global corporations don't know the phrase corporate patriotism. They grew up in this country. They were bailed out by U.S. taxpayers when they got in trouble. They were saved by the U.S. Marines abroad when they got in trouble. But what's their response to the American people? Hey, we're out of here. We're out of here. We're going to fascist and communist dictatorships abroad who know how to keep workers in their place and work like the Dickens with modern capital equipment. And we're out of here to those countries that block you from going to court and block your free speech and block your attempt to form unions and block your attempt to have clean water and clean air. It's disgraceful. The only way I can explain President Obama's position here is he hasn't read the agreement. He's working off memos by the corporate-dominated U.S. Trade Representative right next to the White House or by the corporate lobbies, and he hasn't read it. Now, for example, he says this is good for American workers in the middle class. Okay, well, he's already had a test case. He said the same thing about the U.S.-Korea trade agreement in 2012. He promised jobs. He promised a win-win situation with Korea. And what did he get? He lost 65,000 jobs and $12 billion more in trade deficit. For the last 35 years, with 1 year exception, early on, we have had growing, booming trade deficits with foreign countries. That means we buy more from them than we sell to them. That means we're exporting jobs. How many years of evidence do these free traders, who might be called free trade tours, need before they stop trying to ram these agreements down America's throat? These are pull-down trade agreements. Not only that, they're far more than trade. He just talks about trade, but only about 7 of the 29 chapters deal with trade, you know, tariffs, quotas, etc. The rest work overtime to subordinate our environmental, consumer, and worker rights here to the imperatives of international commercial trade. Here's how it works. Under the Trans-Pacific Agreement, just like the World Trade Organization, if Bangladesh or Vietnam ship products to the U.S. made by brutalized child labor in dungeon factories, we cannot block them. Even though it's illegal in this country to buy products made by child labor in the U.S., and it's been illegal for a century, we cannot block them. Because if the Senate and the House approve this Trans-Pacific Agreement, it has the force of federal law. And the agreement says that we cannot block any imports based on how they're produced, namely child labor, with one exception, prison labor. Child labor is an okay thing. Now, let's say we ban in this country a cancer-causing chemical in the workplace. And let's say this chemical comes from China. All right, the Chinese can say, your prohibition is a non-tariff trade barrier and it violates the Trans-Pacific Agreement, and you've got to drop that regulation and revoke it. And suppose the U.S. says, nuts to you, we're going to do it to protect our workers. Well, China goes to a secret tribunal. They don't have to go to our courts. These agreements bypass our courts, legislature, and regulatory agencies. They can go to a secret tribunal in Geneva. Under the WTO, they're in Geneva. And before a secret tribunal, no, I'm not kidding you, a secret tribunal with three judges that moonlight as corporate lawyers, no dissent allowed, no written dissent allowed, they issue the opinion, and China will win because they can invoke this prohibition. China will win. And then what happens? We're fine. And who pays the fine? The U.S. taxpayer. Now, that's why President Obama doesn't want to debate Senator Elizabeth Warren, which I recommended in a letter last week. They're both from Harvard Law School. No one's going to shout at each other. President Obama has said that Senator Warren is wrong on the facts. Those are exact words, wrong on the facts. All right, I said, why don't you debate her? Sitting Vice President Al Gore, you remember, he debated NAFTA with Ross Perot before a national television audience. Well, I submit that President Obama loves soliloquies. He loves to go on David Letterman. He loves to go on television without any rebuttal, without any challenge by moderators who don't know anything about the agreement. I don't even know enough to ask him whether he's read the agreements, since he spends so much time in March Madness and the rankings of the basketball teams. You'd think he'd have time to read, because he was former president of the Harvard Law Review and a teacher of law at University of Chicago. So what I'm asking you, listeners, is just send a message to the White House and a copy to Senator Warren. Mr. President, debate Senator Warren before tens of millions of people so we can be educated about this agreement before it is sent through a fast track in a month and then voted on in the fall.
We're speaking with Ralph Nader. His recent book at Seven Stories Press is titled Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015.
Ralph, I want to go back to you on the book. You challenged the use of drones. You challenged the civilian deaths in the 9/11 wars all over the world today. What's your biggest concern about the U.S. NATO military empire in the world?
Well, all empires devour themselves. The Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, they all devour themselves because they get overextended in their empire all over the world, and we have bases in 120 countries, not to mention active military attacks and incursions and drones. And the devouring process is that half of the entire federal budget, not counting the insurance, Medicare and Medicaid, but half of the entire U.S. federal budget goes to military purposes. And what does that mean? That means while we're blowing apart all kinds of operations abroad, killing civilians, spreading Al-Qaeda offshoots in all kinds of countries, hating us, in other words, we're producing what we are allegedly trying to curtail, that money is not being used to build in your community the necessary public facility. It's not being used to renovate or build or remodel public buildings, sewage and water systems, libraries, community health clinics, roads, public transit, bridges that are crumbling all over the country. All this would create jobs, rebuilding the inner cities. All this would create jobs, good-paying jobs that cannot be exported to China or elsewhere. And that's part of the devouring process. The second devouring process is on our civil liberties. It's on the climate of fear, the arrest of hundreds of people at times of crisis without charges, throwing them in jail, sometimes without letting even them have attorneys. And the more extreme thing is Guantanamo, where there are like 68 prisoners that have been cleared by all the federal security agencies in Washington years ago as innocent, and they're still in jail in Guantanamo. So our civil liberties go down, our civic freedoms, our freedom to dissent, to speak out, the climate of fear. People think files are going to be kept on them. No kidding. That they're not paranoid. Files now in a computer world is a very easy thing to do. And the third way they devour democracies is that they exclude people who would be great for this country from entering politics, because it's so easy to war bait them. It's so easy to propagandize them Bill O'Reilly style or Rush Limbaugh style or the crazed warmongers that now walk the corridors of Congress, most of them Republicans. So you see, that's the main issue right now. If you say we're not paying enough attention to our children and to our schools and to our parks and to our public transit and to our arts and to the safety at home and our homes and streets, well, you know, the empire is active abroad. It's sucking the vitals out of the U.S. And President Obama now, in his haste to try to get through the Trans-Pacific Agreement, is trying to use the national security argument. I mean, pretty soon he'll be playing the terror card. You know, we got to open up our markets one way for greater deficits and subordinate our health and environment and worker standards because of national security. He's even used that. He got Premier Abe from Japan to come and talk to Congress, and he used the national security card as a reason to have Congress pass a Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. So you see, that's the main issue, and answer your question.
Ralph Nader, you wrote another article recently for the Conference on the Israeli Lobby, and you talked about the press blackout at the press club. Can you talk to us a little bit about this? You wrote this a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, this should be maybe a chapter in Project Censored next year. There was a meeting at the National Press Club. You know, that's a known destination for the press. It's a prestigious building in downtown Washington. And it was April 10th, and the subject was, the Israel lobby, is it good for the U.S., is it good for Israel? And it had a wide variety of speakers. Gideon Levy from Haaretz, a newspaper, came over from Israel. Richard Falk, the U.N. rapporteur on Palestine matters for a number of years, was there. Other people domestically based were there. It was a very rational, civil discourse. And the people who started this was the magazine called Middle East Report that was started by two retired ambassadors to Middle East countries who thought that the story over there was being skewed and the people in our country were not getting the truth. So they advanced this conference very well. They contacted the Washington Post, New York Times, AP, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, the television, the radio, the independent media. And the day came and went, and there was not a single word written on it. This is really an amazing blackout. And I called my column, was which people can get free by going to Nader.org and signing up. I called this column, The Israel Lobby, Press Blackout at the Press Club. And it's really quite astonishing. I called the Washington Post at 10 o'clock on the day of the conference and talked to the deputy national news editor. And as I was making the argument that this was a newsworthy thing, since all the press had covered a few weeks earlier the AIPAC convention and the CPAC, the conservative convention, wall-to-wall they covered it. And C-SPAN covered hours and hours. C-SPAN wasn't there. CNN wasn't there on April 10th. None of the newspapers were there. McClatchy signed up but didn't show up. And so I called the national news editor deputy, and he said, I know exactly what you're talking about. I was the bureau chief for the Post in Jerusalem, and I know what the problem is. I'm going to send a reporter right down to the press building, which is only a few blocks away. Well, he didn't, and there was no coverage. I mean, if this was 1980, you could say, okay, but this is 2015, information age, telecommunication age, social media. Now, the only thing that did get across was streaming, that the sponsors streamed it so people could watch it as it transpired.
Well, Ralph Nader, you know, we were talking earlier about Bernie Sanders, and we mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and, you know, even they seem to be in line with AIPAC.
That's true. There isn't more than 20 members of the Congress out of 535 who will refuse to sign an AIPAC-drafted congressional resolution. I mean, you know, when the Israelis are slaughtering the Gazans and blowing up kids and schools and UN facilities and so on, AIPAC is ramming through Congress with fantastic majorities a resolution condemning the Palestinians. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren has taken the AIPAC oath as she was campaigning for her seat in Massachusetts. Bernie Sanders, a little more skeptical, half and half. One of the problems with Bernie Sanders is he doesn't challenge the military-industrial complex and the empire as much as he should. He's very good on pharmaceutical companies, very good on Wall Street, very good on corporate tax havens, but he's got to strengthen his position on military and foreign policy. He's got to go after the empire.
Well, Ralph Nader, the Israeli defense minister, just this last week talked about how in certain cases they might have to pull a Nagasaki or Hiroshima causing at the end of the fatalities, and was talking about how Israel may need to do this kind of a thing in certain neighborhoods in Gaza, actually assault and kill children after they've already killed 2,200 Palestinians in the past summer, including 563 children.
Well, as you know, just a few days ago, some Israeli soldiers, and are they ever courageous, collaborated in a report that was made public in Israel showing how Israeli soldiers, you know, the preponderance of weaponry is like never in history vis-a-vis the Palestinians resisting occupation and invasion. They were shooting Palestinian civilians out of boredom, the soldiers said. They were just using them as target bait. Who can forget the five or six little boys on the beach who were blown up? You know, all this so-called pinpoint precision missiles? Well, how come they're finding their way to killing over 450 children in the latest invasion of Gaza? In their homes, playing in the streets, etc. You know, Gaza is only twice the size of the District of Columbia. It's got almost 2 million people in it. The soldiers were saying that a lot of the firing was wildly inaccurate, and they didn't care who they hit. And the proof is in the pudding. They hit all kinds of civilian targets.
We're speaking with Ralph Nader. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. You can certainly learn more about Ralph Nader's latest work by going to nader.org. And we can't thank Ralph Nader enough. Not just for being on with us today, but for his half century plus of serious civic activism and providing a significant model for younger generations of how they can be in the driver's seat of their own lives.
Thank you, and Mickey, thanks, Peter.
The one and only Ralph Nader, everybody.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We've just heard an interview Peter and I did with Ralph Nader on May 8th. Now we're going to hear part of a talk Nader gave last summer in Berkeley, California. In this speech, he asserted that the left and the right have common ground on many political issues and should build alliances on those issues, particularly when aligning against the corporate state. Here's the beginning of that speech.
I want to thank KPFA for sponsoring this, and the help of the First Congregational Church here, providing the gathering for what I'm told is an extremely serious, thoughtful, and dynamic gathering of citizens, which is the premise of the book. The book is not designed for people who want easy answers or who want ideological rhetoric. It's for people who adhere to Aldous Huxley's old saying that facts do not cease to exist because they're ignored. And we have a huge reality out there that's ignored. It's replaced by myths. Myths are systems of control, as we know, throughout history. Our myths are very pervasive. They're historical myths. They're myths about the economy, about the election, about our democratic pretenses. They're even myths about voters. And voters have a huge responsibility that they cannot escape by contrived cynicism and pox on all your houses and not getting involved in politics or civic activity, because it all starts with the quality of the citizenry. However we assign responsibility, accountability, prosecution, blame, it all starts with the quality of the citizenry. At certain levels, it lifts the society. It makes our descendants proud of us. Other levels, it can incrementally contribute to decay. At other levels, we let other powerful interests do it to us unjustly. At other levels, we do it to ourselves. So it's very important when you meet people who are withdrawn, who don't rally to save the Berkeley post office building, people who don't support listener-supported radio, people who think that voting doesn't matter because the choices are so narrow, sometimes there's only one in gerrymandered districts. All these are simply excuses for withdrawal instead of provocations for involvement. So that's personality. You see them. I'm sure you've seen them. You phone people begging them to come out, right, for city council and marches and votes and rallies and courtrooms. And you're not trying to persuade them. They already agree with you. But they're otherwise preoccupied. Or they don't have time. Or they want to watch their local show. or see their sports team. Or even if they go, what difference does it make? Whatever will be, the big boys prevail. How many times have you heard that? How many times have you said to yourself, well, you know, I go fishing with Judy or Roy, but I never talk politics with them because they're right-wingers. You don't talk politics with right-wingers. You only talk politics with people who agree with you, if that. The premise of this book is multiple. One is that a huge number of people want to get things done in this country that long overdue. A lot of the things that got done in Western Europe or Canada, like universal health care, it's all done. Western Europe, like 4 weeks to 7 weeks paid vacation, like tuition-free higher education, except in England, which is reverted, like decent public transit that's not expensive, like paid daycare, like paid family sick leave, like paid maternity leave. Yeah, people say, well, that's higher taxes. But look what they get for it. They don't get 15 inches of computerized billing that's inscrutable and part of a $280 billion annual fraud on the patients. $280 billion would be. They don't have children so saddled with debt that either they don't continue their higher education, or if they finish, they spend their 20s. They should be their most creative, innovative years. They may have more wisdom and judgment later. And they're afraid to do it. They're risk-averse. Bad enough, their jobs are being exported under corporate-managed trade agreements to fascist and communist countries abroad, who know how to keep their workers in their place, 80 cents an hour. But they can't operate. They're saddled with a collective debt bigger than the entire credit card debt of the American people. It's now $1.2 trillion. You don't see that in Western Europe. You talk to a group of students in Germany or France or Italy, and you say, I'm from America. Let's talk about student debt. They talk, you mean about the $25 student fee that just went up to 30? For which they had a rally? I saw that in Sydney, Australia once. They were all over the campus, and they were, it's outrageous. The fee went up for a variety of services to $50. And I'm saying, well, what do you pay for tuition? Is what is that? So the first premise is taking yourself seriously. You got to get people to take themselves seriously. Stop giving up on themselves. Stop quitting from the democratic society, which only further concentrate power. When people quit from their obligations, they're complicit with concentrated power, evil. When 100 senators unanimously signed AIPAC's resolution during the butchery of the Gazan civilians and their electric plants and their power plants and their sewage and hospitals and schools, they are complicit in international war crimes. The second premise of the book is expectation levels. Political cynics do it to themselves, often without even realizing it. Part of the cynicism in the withdrawal is reducing their expectation levels of what they'd expect from Sacramento and from Washington, of what they should expect from their elected officials, and what they should expect from their executive officials and their judicial magistrates and judges. In fact, I have often urged elected officials right down to small-town mayors, why don't you put out what you expect of the people? They're always hammering you, the few who are active, they're always hammering you to do this and this. Why don't you put out a declaration? This is what we expect in terms of civic engagement, which includes showing up. Half of democracy is showing up, is it not? It's showing up at marches, at elections, at rallies, at courtrooms, again and again and again. If we don't show up, nothing will happen except for the worst. Because who shows up? The 1% show up. They have the highest voting turnout percentage-wise of anybody in the country. The rich vote. They do other things, too. They control 95% of as much wealth as the bottom 95% of the American people. Can you imagine a concentration of power like that? What would Jefferson have said? They control huge amounts of the income. 95% of the gains in the last 10 years have gone to the top 5%. So they're very engaged. But what we need is just 1% of people who are active, distributed in congressional districts, that's 3 million people, connected with one another, starting Congress watchdog groups with full-time staff, 4 in each district, easy, when you have, what, 2,000-3,000 people pledging to give 200 hours volunteer a year and raising the money for 4 full-time people and connecting with others in 435 districts around a major redirection of long-overdue policies in the United States? Is that too much to ask? I think there are 3 million serious bird watchers. I'm glad there are. I don't think there's 1,000 serious Congress watchers at that level of commitment.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're spending the hour today with Ralph Nader. Earlier in the show, we did a live interview with Nader, and now we're hearing excerpts from a talk he gave in California in the summer of 2014. In this next excerpt, Ralph Nader identifies some issues where he thinks the left and right can work together, such as limiting federal surveillance of citizens or breaking up giant banks.
The worst thing I can hear from a member of Congress is, well, you think this is so important? We haven't heard from anybody back home. Maybe they lied a bit. But they don't lie when they get a left-right thunderous roll coming in on them, which gets to the point of the book. If we want to get things done in this country, and there are a lot of things that can get done, we have a lot of problems in our country we don't deserve, and a lot of solutions we don't apply. Take energy, take housing, take employment, take living wage, take universal health care, take cracking down on corporate crime with adequate prosecution budgets, take ending empire, take coming back home instead of blowing apart countries, building the United States right down to the community level with jobs that can't be exported. That's called public works repair and renovation. All over. Now, I don't sugarcoat the left-right alliances that are already operational, and I'll get to them, or they're just public opinion. Like 80% of the people want this. 90% of the people want to break up the big New York banks that are too big to fail so they don't crash on the taxpayer again into a depression and unemployment and loss of trillions in pensions. So part of the left-right alliance is public opinion. The next stage is when it becomes more organized and visible. It could be as random as the mass of emails that came in last year, 60-1 in some senatorial offices, 100-1 in some House offices. You are not going to plunge this country into another war in Syria. And what happened? Both the members of Congress, both the parties, and the president. That was the end. Boy, that took a lot of energy, didn't it? A few 100,000 emails, maybe a few tens of thousands of phone calls and letters. It's easier than we think. And when I say that, I'm not sugarcoating, engaging in Pollyannish whimsy. I've seen it in the past. 1% of the people, or less, have been responsible for the greatest social justice movements in our country, especially when they represent what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment, or they have majority opinion behind them. It becomes unstoppable. Last year, after 3 years of opposition by corporate lobbyists, the Whistleblower Protection Act was passed with heavy majorities. How come the corporate lobbyists lost? You think they want federal employees to have whistleblower protection to blow the whistle on corporate fraud on Medicare, Medicaid, military contracts? It's a big honeypot. They get away with hundreds of billions of dollars, not to mention the tax system. What does it take to turn it around? Far less than we're bred from elementary school on up, learning how to memorize, regurgitate, vegetate, learning how to be powerless, not learning any civic skills or experience in elementary school and high school. What do you expect people to turn into? Raging civic advocates after that kind of debilitation? That kind of crushing the idealism of 10-year-olds who can ask the toughest questions that politicians have ever heard before they learn conformity and internal repression in their teen years? Now, why is it that almost all the attention of civic conflict is on conflict? Why is it we hear endlessly where left-right are in serious disagreement, and we don't hear where they are in serious agreement? They are in serious disagreement, let's say, on reproductive rights, school prayer, constitutionally required balanced budget, gun control, things like that. We know them. And that's what the press focuses on. That's what the politicians divide on. That's how they raise money on. But then, where's the agreement areas? The agreement areas are the areas that challenge the status quo and the power structure. You think they want to focus on that? One of the oldest techniques of plutocracy and oligarchy is divide and rule. Divide and rule. How do you divide and rule? You focus every time you turn on the news and read the television, read the newspapers and hear the talk. It's all on the conflict. Now, I was just on the Ron Owen show, and he was doing this book, Unstoppable. This book gave him problems because it dealt with agreement. And he admitted it to me. He says, I'm going to pick some of the 25 areas of convergence that I have on page 65, 66 listed, and I'm going to disagree with you. I said, Ron, this is about convergence, left-right alliance on very controversial subjects that may affect your advertisers, of course. This is off the radio. And he was fair enough. But you see, all talk radio shows, with few exceptions, especially the big ones like Limbo and Hannity and so on, the soliloquists, they're the ones who focus only on this kind of conflict. And it's interesting. It's not conflict between corporations. That would affect their ads. It's not where corporations sue corporations. They don't like that. It's conflicts, you know, red meat, as they say, conflicts that we're all so familiar with, including racial conflicts, gender conflicts, ethnic conflicts, plus all the ones that I just listed. So here are some left-right alliances. They're in various stages. They're either in public opinion, and they go nowhere beyond that. They either end up in marches, and then they get the media, and then they're so forceful, and they have stamina, that they get on the table of the one party or the other, or one candidate or the other. And once they're on the table, they're going to be discussed. Once they're discussed, they're often reported, especially if it's the two parties, not the third party. And once they're reported, the pollsters swing into action, and you have the dynamic that starts moving toward victory of sorts. So let's start with just the public opinion before it's gone operational. And I'll be very brief on this just to go through. Because it's important to see what stage we're at here. Breaking up the big banks comes in at 90%. It's not operational. Therefore, you don't have many hearings in Congress, and you don't have many politicians staking the next election on that issue, among others. Challenging the Patriot Act and its vicious restrictions on librarians and on being able to search your home without telling you for 72 hours. How's that for the Fourth Amendment? That's not operational yet. That comes in a heavy majority. In fact, I interviewed Ed Crane, who is one of the founders of the Cato Institute. You can't get more libertarian than that. And he's very crisp. And he said to me, Ralph, I have it in the book. He said, Ralph, I oppose all corporate subsidies, unconstitutional wars, the freedom restrictions of the Patriot Act, and the Federal Reserve running amok. I said to him, Ed, that's a pretty good start. That's a pretty good start.
And that was Ralph Nader speaking in July 2014 in Berkeley, California. Earlier in today's show, we had a live interview with Ralph Nader about his new book, Return to Sender, out now by Seven Stories Press. That concludes our program for this week. Thanks for listening. The Project Censored Show is heard on 22 stations around the U.S. To listen to this show again or hear any previous Project Censored show, visit the archives at www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time. Cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got